I take my text from that 20th chapter of John's Gospel, verse 29. Jesus said to Thomas, "Do you believe because you see me? How happy are those who believe without seeing me?" Now, as you know, we're in that period of the church year between Easter and Resurrection, Easter and the Resurrection and Ascension Day. For some reason, this period doesn't seem to have attracted any official title, as, for example, have Advent before Christmas and so on, other periods of the church year. And so has, by custom, come to be known by its duration as the 40 days. There are 40 days between Christ's resurrection and his ascension. But we may ask ourselves, if Christ had, by his crucifixion and resurrection, conquered sin and death, surely he had achieved all the objectives which he'd been sent for. Why then did he not ascend directly to heaven after the resurrection? What possible purpose could there be in lingering on the earth for another 6 weeks? Now, I want to propose this morning that there was a purpose, a very good purpose, and that the meaning of this will become clear if we look closely at the three major stories of this 40-day period. The first of these stories occurs on the day of resurrection itself, late in the evening on Easter Day, and we read of it in John's Gospel. The 11 remaining disciples are, we are told, hiding from the Jewish authorities, hiding behind locked doors, scared men, fearing that they will be the next to be arrested, tried and punished by some cruel method. We wonder if, in fact, it was the upper room that was used for the Last Supper that they were now hiding in, but we'll never know in this life the answer to that question. But however secure they felt they were, suddenly Jesus was there in their midst. Presumably, Jesus' resurrected body was a new spiritual body which could pass effortlessly through doors and walls whenever he wanted to move around. And Jesus greeted them with the peace. Then he displayed to them the wounds in his hands and the place where the Roman spear had entered his side as he hung on the cross. So his body, however spiritual it may have been, still bore the wound marks of his earthly body. But one of the disciples, Thomas, happened not to be present on that occasion. When they told him that they'd seen Jesus, and seen Jesus on his feet walking again, and had even examined the wound marks of the crucifixion, Thomas refused to believe them. A matter-of-fact chap was Thomas, would only believe what he saw with his own eyes. "Unless I see the scars for myself and feel the wound in his side, I won't believe you," he said. "I think you're making it all up." A week later, the disciples were again hiding in that upper room. Once again, the doors were locked. But the difference was that this time, Thomas was present. All the 11 remaining disciples were there together. And once again, Jesus was suddenly standing among them. When they had recovered from their surprise, Jesus greeted them with the peace. And then he turned to Thomas and said, put your finger here in this wound, Thomas. Then put your hand into this wound in my side. Stop doubting, Thomas, and believe what you see with your own eyes. Thomas, now realizing his dreadful error in doubting, could only stutter out, my Lord and my God. And Jesus said to him, Thomas, you believe because you see me. Happy are all those who believe without seeing me. For if Christ's message was to be seriously presented to the people, it was absolutely essential that all the disciples should positively witness to that message. One dissenter from the truth would undermine the whole Christian mission. And of course, it wouldn't be long before the number of those who believed without seeing far exceeded those who had seen Jesus in the flesh and believed. It was the job of the new church to bring Christ's message to those who had not seen, as it is, of course, today. Now, the second of these stories of the resurrected Jesus also occurs on the day of resurrection, in the evening. And we go to St. Luke's for this story, the well-known story of the walk to Emmaus, a much-loved, highly evocative tale. Two of Jesus' followers were walking away from Jerusalem to the village of Emmaus, about 7 miles away on the rocky, dusty roads of those days. One of them, we are told, was named Cleopas, but that's just about all about that we know about them. They were part of the larger group of Jesus' disciples who were not included in the inner band of 12, and yet who followed him closely. They were possibly leaving Jerusalem because it had become dangerous for known disciples of Jesus to be there. It would be safer at Emmaus, across the valley, outside the city, where the temple police rarely visited. And as they walked along, they were naturally discussing the astonishing events of Good Friday and Easter Sunday. And as they walked, Jesus drew near and accompanied them on their journey. For some reason, about which we can only speculate, they failed to recognize him. They saw him as a stranger. But Jesus, in his resurrected body, did seem to be difficult to recognize on other occasions. And Jesus said, what are you talking about so seriously as you walk along? And Cleopas and his friends stopped, looking sad and serious, and they said to Jesus, are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who doesn't know what's been going on there these last few days? What things? Asked Jesus innocently. But everything that happened to Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet sent by God and considered by all the people to be powerful in everything that he said and did. The chief priest handed him over to the Romans to be crucified. We had high hopes that he would free Israel from the Romans and all foreign powers once and for all. It's now the third day since he died, but some of our women folk went to the tomb and found that his body had gone. They claimed to have met angels there who told them that Jesus was still alive. So some of our group also went to the tomb, but they also found it empty and no trace of Jesus. Then Jesus said to them, "How foolish you are, how slow to believe the words of the prophets." And he interpreted to them all that the scriptures prophesied about himself, from the books of Moses to the words of the prophets, that God's chosen one would suffer and die for the salvation of God's people. Well, soon they reached their destination, the village of Emmaus. It was getting dark, and they invited Jesus to stay the night. He accepted that, and at supper with them, he took the bread and broke it and shared it with them. And in that action, they realized who it was they'd been walking with. And they rushed back to the other disciples to tell them that Christ was alive again and walking in the world, and that he had explained to them as they journeyed how it was that his death and resurrection, which perfectly fulfilled the scriptural prophecies, were necessary for the salvation of humankind. For the third of our resurrection stories, we return again to the Gospel of John. And this is the story of the miraculous catch of fishes. And this would have seemed to have occurred several days after the resurrection, because it means that the disciples have decided now to leave Jerusalem, where it was too dangerous for a follower of Jesus to be spotted, and that they had made the journey back to their homeland in Galilee. Well, they've got to make a living somehow, haven't they? And so the fishermen have gone back to their lake, to the nets and their boats, and to their old occupations. It all seems a bit dull somehow now without Jesus. They fish at night, and so it is that we find seven sad fishermen out in the dark, trawling on the lake. But if they were sad to start with, they're even sadder as the night comes to an end. For as the sun begins to rise, they all call out to each other that they've caught nothing. It's been a failure. None of the boats have caught anything. It's been a fruitless, or should we say, a fishless night's work. But as the light gets brighter with the rising sun, they notice a solitary figure standing at the water's edge. The light isn't quite good enough yet for them to identify who it is. But then the stranger calls out to them, "Young men, have you caught anything?" he says. "Nothing at all," they reply. "Then throw your net out on the right side of the boat," says the stranger. "Then you'll catch some fish." They do exactly as he has said. There's no harm in trying after all. But now when they pull the net in again, they find it's too heavy to drag it back into the boat. It's full up with fish. Now the disciple known as the disciple whom Jesus loved, who's generally identified as John, he was the first to realize who the figure on the shore must be. "It is the Lord," he cried out. And when Peter realized that the mysterious stranger was the resurrected Jesus, he too dived into the water, hoping to be the first ashore to greet Jesus, thus leaving the others with the strenuous task of towing the net ashore, containing, John's Gospel tells us, 153 fish. Presumably, they had to be counted afterwards so they could be shared equally between them. But when they got ashore, they found a fire burning already, to their surprise, and fish already cooking on it, and there was bread ready as well for the meal. And Jesus invited them to contribute some of their fish. And so we have this beautiful picture of the lake and the beach in the light of dawn as the resurrected Jesus and seven of his disciples take breakfast together. But the story has, like everything in St. John's Gospel, a message and a moral. Greek scholars in those days, the early days of science, had attempted to calculate the number of different fishes in the world, and the number they had arrived at was 153 species of fish. So what John is saying to us here is that the net of Christ is big enough and broad enough to take in all fish, I mean all the people of all races. There is room in the church for everyone on earth, and it's the duty of the church to embrace all the peoples of the earth, not just a chosen race or two. However many they may be, they are chosen for the church. And the mission of the church then, as today, is Christ for the world and the world for Christ. No one is to be excluded from his church. And it's the church's mission to reach out to all people everywhere, to give them the opportunity of hearing the message that Jesus brings to us, and to do our utmost to bring them into the fellowship of his kingdom, the fellowship of our church. So may the church go strong in extending his kingdom in this neighborhood and throughout the world, and may many come to know his presence in their lives, to the glory of his kingdom. Amen.